Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. I usually keep my books in order according to topic. Like all my Mets books are together, all my individual team books are together, all the books about World War II are together. The only exception I have are for two authors, two of my favorite authors. One is the late Leonard Coppett, where I have all his books assembled in what I call Coppett's Corner. And the other are the books by Paul Dixon, who is a wordsmith, not so much in that he creates words, but how he reports on them. These include his eponymous Baseball Dictionary, now in its third edition, and the re-release of his book, The Hidden Language of Baseball, which is what we chat about in today's bookshelf conversation.
Paul Dixon, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you, Ron.
So this book came out originally more than 15 years ago. Why was there the need to do a revision?
Well, the original one out of print, which is the author's fear, great, you know, sort of a nightmare, and I was able to find the wonderful people at University of Nebraska Press who were interested in the book, so we decided to rewrite it and bring it up to date, right up to the Apple Watchgate incident of 2 years ago, and look at just all the changes, even in those 15 years, as electronics become more and more of a factor in science and sign stealing.
As a quick review, could you remind us what that Apple Watch thing was?
Oh, that was a business where it was a game between the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Of course.
And the Yankees ratted on the Red Sox, and then the Red Sox, that they were passing signals from the TV monitors to the Apple Watch in the dugout, and then the Red Sox made a counterclaim against the Yankees, and then both teams were fined for, and the Yankees were fined for something that happened years earlier, and all the fines, I think one was $300,000, one was $100,000, went to hurricane relief. But it was just sort of the tip of the iceberg of all that's going on out there in sign stealing and signs.
So the sign stealing and signs, the first book I can recall about that specifically was Joshua Prager's book about the 1951 Dodgers and Giants playoff game.
Yes.
Where there was accusations that they were using a telescope in the scoreboard. Is that correct?
In the bleachers.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the allegation, what had happened, it first came out in 1962, but we'll go back all the way back. 1951, the Dodgers were 13.5 games out of first. It comes down to this one game with the Giants. They've made this amazing sort of recovery, it's the game in which Bobby Thompson hits this. They've got all sorts of names for it, but the miracle of whatever.
Coogan's Wharf.
Yeah, right, and. So about 1962, it first came out that somebody, an anonymous person, tipped off the AP that Thompson had been tipped, that Thompson had been given the pitch from Frank Branca, that a guy with a telescope in the bleachers had picked up the pitch. And it was sort of written off then. I mean, everybody said it was impossible because Whitey Lockman was on second, and he said he couldn't even see the signs, let alone the guy in the bleachers being able to see the signs and transmit them back to the dugout, and then transmit them to the batter. And Rube Walker, who was the catcher for the Giants that day, said he was using seven different sequences, and it was impossible. But then along about all of a sudden, the Wall Street Journal comes out with the Joshua Prager thing and says, no, there really was sign stealing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I really set out in the book, originally the original book, and in this one again, I've redoubled up on it, that there was a huge amount of evidence that said it did not happen. Everybody was, in those days, everybody was stealing signs.
Right.
But the fact is, in this particular case, with a guy on second, with a guy on second, you know the Dodgers catcher is not going to just do the simple, you know, fastball, curveball, changeup with his fingers. He's going to disguise them. They may not even be with his fingers. So everybody's saying it was with a guy in second. You're especially alert to, you know, sign stealing because he's going to easily signals the batter, including the position of the batter of the where this catcher is setting up, as well as the signal. And Lachman said he couldn't even see the sign, and he was on second.
And nowadays you have situations where every time defense talks to each other, they put their gloves over their mouths so the television can't pick up what they're saying for the lip readers in the audience.
Yeah, no, it's become sort of a ballet about trying to prevent this. And there's, you know, it's no matter what. I mean, the commissioner said last year that he might try to outlaw sign stealing and make it a penalty. But there's so many aspects to it that you cannot imagine. I mean, electronic sign stealing is one thing when you're using those TV cameras and such. But a lot of sign stealing is just interpreting whatever person is giving the sign. You know, it's going to be not just the catcher and the pitcher, but, you know, with the sign steal, double steals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all over the field, there are signs being given. The second baseman and the shortstop are signaling to each other how to position themselves for the if there's a guy on first. The umpires are signing, besides the obvious ones with the jerk of the thumb. The umpires are signing and signaling to each other, and so there are a lot of people out there trying to figure out what the other team is doing by interpreting the signs. And one of the most basic things is really not technically the same as stealing the actual sign, but the interpretation of tells, watching a player, a pitcher, for example, who does something strange with his shoulder when he's about to throw a changeup, or a Ty Cobb famously stuck out his tongue when he was going to out of the side of his mouth when he's going to steal, and certain players knew that and they could set up for the steal. So they're sort of like goes back to poker. They call them tells,
right,
where you give up what your hand is by some involuntary or subconscious movement or behavior.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the umpires because it's something when I read it, I never realized that before. There's a situation where the umpires will protect each other if the manager comes out to argue.
Yeah. One of the ones, again, some of the reporting is a little bit older, so it may have changed, but one of the things they would do is if they want another umpire, if a manager's in an umpire's face, and he wants the other he wants to get out of the situation, and he doesn't want it to develop any further, he puts his hands on his hips, and another ump will then come in between them and let him get out of there. So what the umpires are doing with their signs and signals, they're trying to keep the game under control. And one of the reasons we have, you know, no soccer riots and things in America, they really do work. Really do work hard to keep everything under control, including the expectations of the crowd. And they're out there to diffuse situations.
Well, no, I'm certainly going to pay more attention when I watch the games to see the umpires' hands on hips during arguments. As I think it's fair to call you an older fan. Happy belated birthday, by the way.
Thank you. I'm 80.
I know. what do you think about? Do you think there's too much technology in the game?
I mean, I'm not a big fan of the TV review in New York. I watched a couple very hot games in D.C. where it was clearly the Nationals were playing. Where clearly one of the managers was using the review almost as a technique to wear out the other team. You know, you're going. You look at a time when the heat on the field is 95 degrees on an afternoon, because it's hotter on the ground than it is in the stands. And you look at a game in which all of a sudden there's a challenge, and they're looking at New York, and the team in the field is now, those guys are really hot, and they're squatting, and they're trying to, you know, keep cool. And, you know, I think it slows down the game. So I'm not a big fan of that, but technology is inevitable, and you've got to come to grips with it. And I'm not, again, it's old guy versus what we've got to do to fix the game. So I tend to be against the robotic umpire and such. It's part of the fabric of the game to have an occasional bad call.
Now, one of the things I've noticed lately, and I'm wondering why it isn't used more often. Well, this isn't used at all. Let me back up a little bit. I'm wondering why there can't be a situation, like in football, where the coaches can communicate directly with the players through earpieces to tell the pitcher, you know, what pitch to throw, to tell the defensive position how to move, and that way you eliminate the catcher altogether when it comes to giving signals.
Yeah, I mean, but it's some of it's so instantaneous, and some of it's so, I mean, these guys have been learning this from Little League on up. And I think you've got it. It's sort of the rhythm of being a player. I mean, one of the things when I did the book originally, I kept asking people, how many signs and signals, if you count all the dummy signs, you know, when a third base coach looks like he's swatting off mosquitoes and his hands are going up and down, and those are a lot. But somebody, and several people confirmed this, in a tight Major League Baseball game, not a blowout, but in a game that's contested right to the end, there are likely to be about 1,000 signals put out there, and a lot of it, you know, if you look at the analogy of baseball, a lot of baseball comes out of the Civil War, and the whole idea of the battery, the pitcher and the catcher, a general in a battle is in uniform, the manager in a big game is in uniform, you've got lieutenants, who are the first and third base coaches, who are sort of, you've got the top sergeant, who's the catcher, and you've got signs and signals, because the Civil War is the first time in history in which the enlisted guy, the soldier on the ground, was sending and receiving signals. They were using flags, they were using torches, and of course, what immediately happened was, if one side was signaling something, they would be coding it to keep it from the other side. But the other side had men whose job was to decode that signal. So part of it is the whole knit and fabric of the game is sort of the players have to be smart and alert. And I think the fact that a catcher really has better control of the field because he's looking out there and he knows exactly what's going on than have somebody else call it in for him.
No.
Go ahead. Sorry.
One of the things I've also noticed is that on occasion catchers will wear wristbands that have information on them.
Yep.
What is that about?
Oh, they're sequences in which they can signal. And the pitcher may have one in his hat band with the same. It'll give a number which is a certain sequence of pitches as opposed to individual pitches. And the ironic thing is that comes out of softball. Softball's been doing that for years. These wristbands, but that's more and more teams are doing that. And again, it's always counter espionage. You're doing things. And one of the reasons, and one of the growth of the bench coach. Remember when Don Zimmer was the dugout assistant manager? One of his major jobs was to steal signs and to interpret sequences, and they basically give clues. So it's a whole, you know, spy versus spy kind of thing.
With the growth of foreign players from all different countries, how is that playing the communication between pitcher and catcher?
I've never really asked that question directly of anyone who plays the game, but it seems to me that it would be fairly simple because a lot of the communication is nonverbal. And, pitcher gives a sign, and then the catcher sets up. And if the pitcher doesn't like the way the catcher's setting up, he shakes his head and shakes it off, and they start all over again. So a lot of it is probably easier to do because language, even though language in different languages intrude.
This is the second edition of this book. You've put out three editions of the Dixon Baseball Dictionary.
Yeah.
Now, is there a fourth coming out?
Well, it's the last one was huge, and each one was another 1,000. I don't know what it was, but I mean the numbers were huge in terms of the number of entries. The last book was 4.5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost $50, but 4.5 pounds. But actually, if you bought it by the pound, it was one of the cheapest books back. but I'm working on it, and I may be. I'm working with. It looks like I'm working with. Doing an online version that will be housed within a larger structure. I'm talking right now very seriously with Baseball Almanac about keeping the dictionary in print as a hardback, sort of as where it was when I wrote the last version.
Mm-hmm.
But then also having an updated version online is through another vehicle, a license with Baseball Almanac, or that's the one I'm talking to right now. That looks like the place will be. So there'll be an element of Baseball Almanac where you can go up and look up a term. Because especially with the growth of analytics, this stuff is changing all the time.
Oh, my goodness. The statistical elements alone are fathoming to try to keep up with those things.
Yeah, and it's very daunting. I mean, I think the fans are not. The people who follow the game, unless they're really true, blue-blooded Saberites or something, some of the stuff is confusing to a lot of people.
Sure.
I mean, and a lot of people, I've talked to very, very sophisticated baseball people, people who've written baseball books and stuff, but when you ask them about war, throw up their hands. They go, I can't figure it out.
Well, I don't know if there's a one definition of war that's agreed upon by everybody.
Right. No, if you see, and then there's war, I mean, then there are variations on war that are so, and I'm reading certain things that are saying some of the players, especially the minor leaguers, are not thrilled with a lot of these new things like launch angle and bat speed and stuff because... apparently, a lot of them have grown up with their goals are stated in terms of RBIs, ERAs. Those have been always the measuring sticks, and now all of a sudden, there are people in the analytics department of major league teams saying, "Well, bat speed is more important than RBIs or something, or batting averages and things, and slugging percentages and the players are confused because they're saying, "Wait a second, this was not the way I was brought into the game. This, the measurements I was looking at, and I thought everybody else was looking at, were these standard ones, which you and I grew up with and know, like the back of our hands."
Well, certainly there are several books that have come out in the past few years that say that those old statistics aren't good measurements. Wins for pitchers, for example. I mean, Jacob DeGrom threw a great game the other day, left with a lead, and then the bullpen comes along and the Mets lose. And in the meantime, if you go by, well, he only won X amount of games. There are very few 20-game winners these days, which used to be a standard of excellence.
Right.
And they're worried that the front office will look at these. Well, your numbers weren't this, that, but I'm guessing the front office, like you say, with launch angle and bat speed, it almost sounds like a further extension of Moneyball when they used to say, well, we're not looking for batting average, we're looking for on-base percentage.
Right, exactly. And of course, the people who run these teams, they need... especially the ones that are down on the bottom of the ladder, they really need some infusion, new way of thinking that helps them crawl out from under. And of course, the great example of the Houston Astros, which used analytics and sort of genius things to get to become a new empire of sorts.
I'm thinking the way that baseball is looking at it. They're looking at who the fans are, and unfortunately, it's turning away from the old-style fans. So they go to the ballpark, and if the game is 3.5 hours, so what? I mean, they come to the ballpark to get away from things, to relax, to enjoy being out. But now it's like, well, yeah, we want to go to the ball game, but we also want to do these other things afterwards, so we hope this game goes on quickly.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's that. I mean, there's all these other factors. Even this year, I don't know what it's been like in other cities, but I live in the Washington, Baltimore area. And of course the Orioles are terrible this year. But a lot. I was at lunch yesterday with a very avid friend of mine. He said he stopped. He didn't go to as many games this year. And I said why? And he said the heat was just so unbearable. And the afternoon games, he actually didn't. And I'm not going to one. But he said, you know, you realize that with this climate change, sitting out there in the bleachers, which comes from the idea that the sun, that's where the sun was going to hit, and you'd be bleached.
Right.
You know, you're that becomes a factor. And he said, one game he was at this year, at a Nationals game, it was a day game, but he said they were passing out ice packs. They had like wheelbarrows filled with ice packs that were passing out to the people watching the game. So you have all these new factors, and it makes it harder to go. I mean, I went to a game the other night, and all of a sudden, these signs were on all the concessions, no cash, credit cards only. But the vendors who go through the stands, they were saying, only cash, no credit cards.
Mm.
So you're sort of in this sort of odd world in which you can't spend cash one place, and you can't use a credit card another place. It becomes sort of a puzzlement, you know, figure it all out.
I also want to touch briefly on another book of yours that I really enjoyed, The Joy of Keeping Score.
Yeah.
Do people keep score anymore?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. They do, and I've talked, every once in a while, somebody like the Wall Street Journal or somebody calls me, that's the most famous one, that they're saying, well, we're doing, or some California paper or something will call them and say, we're doing an article on the death of scoring. And I said, oh, yeah. And I said, you know, I just keep getting feedback from people who love that book and are still keeping score. And I'm finding that even going, if you go to, especially the cheaper seats, which are harder to find these days, but you do find people who still keep score. I was at a game the other night, and within my eyes, you know, within the area that I could see, there were 7 or 8 people scoring. And some people score just as being part of the game. I think what the appeal of scoring is, I remember it being years ago at a game at Yankee Stadium, and there was a guy, I was with a guy, we were both keeping score, and there was a play that was called an error, and the guy sitting next to me scored it as a hit. And I said, no, you can't do that. He says, yes, I can. This is my scorebook. You know, you almost feel like you're in control of the game if you look at the scorecard.
Mm-hmm.
No, but there's still people who contact me about scoring and tell me how much they love it. And I guess it's sort of an analog response to a digital world. I'm sure there's an iPhone or a smartphone application to keep score with. But sometimes that number 2 pencil and the, you know, the spiral-bound scorebook are more fun.
And we've been talking with Paul Dixon, author of The Hidden Language in Baseball and many other excellent baseball books. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was our conversation with Paul Dixon. Tune in again next time and we'll have another fascinating visitor from the world of baseball pop culture. In the meantime, visit Ron Kaplan's baseball bookshelf for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on our favorite sport. And remember, if you have a question or comment, please, please send them to me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder.